personally, you know, as the day goes on, I degrade rapidly. You know, up until around 1 o'clock, I am on it. Time 4 or 5 comes, and if I were to be working 13 or 14 hour shifts, those last couple hours, I'm just doing my best to hang on. You know, all you can think of is, this has got to end soon. You know, I'm not looking forward to seeing that room full of patients out in the waiting room. I just can't wait to see them.
I got to stop going late in the afternoon.
It's unrealistic. Yeah,
is that when you do it?
The more embarrassing your condition, the earlier in the day you should go.
Yeah.
Somebody give me the doctor. You better follow the ambulance out. Deep in shock. Oh, lovely baby.
Hey everybody, welcome to Ari Shapiro's Skeptic Tank. Quick intro this time, 2 minutes. I'm going to have Dr. Steve Graham on this podcast to talk about what it's like to actually be a doctor, the ins and outs of it, what it's like to be a physician, practicing. It's not as cool as you think it'd be. Dr. Steve, he's an old friend of Joe Rogan's, but when my knee was really acting up and I couldn't figure out what was going on, he told me the real deal with what hospitals do. Like, I had MRIs done on my knee that just reported, nah, everything's fine in there. And so I was like, well, I don't know what it is, but every time I sit down or stand up, anytime I bend my knee and put pressure on it, it just buckles. Like, so he told me MRIs give you a false negative 20% of the time. Yeah, I don't think it'll give a false positive. So if something's wrong in there and it says something's wrong. But when it says everything's fine, 4 out of 5 times that's right, and 1 out of 5 times it's just not right. So he just told me, like, go in and scope it. You know something's wrong. And I did, and they found stuff once they were in there, and now my knees are both great. I went skiing in the Alps this year. And I'm thinking I'm going to go skiing outside Denver. Anyways, really cool. And then my co-host on this episode was a UFC fighter named Jeremy Horn. Those guys were hanging out together. We did this in Las Vegas right before the Anderson Silva-Chris Weidman fight, in my hotel room at the MGM. And it was cool. So Jeremy Horn was there, so I was like, fuck it, join us. Why not? So he joined in too and added a little bit. Yeah, if you haven't gotten my last week's episode, it was just my album. I put out my album, Revenge for the Holocaust, with commentary. So people really people liked it. So why don't you check it out? It's just a free comedy album with some, like, me telling you, like, where the bits came from and whatever struggle I had with each bit. You should do it. And speaking of me taping stuff, I am getting ready to do another hour this year. I don't know what I'm going to do, whether it's a special or a CD. I don't really know yet. And honestly, I don't really care that much. I took on this task of writing a new hour a year, and it's been, well, 12 and a half months now since I recorded, so it's time for me to get going again. I think I might try to do it in Chicago. I'm going to be at Zany's the last week of February. It's a short month. So come out to those shows. Zany's in Chicago. There's one on Friday. I'm doing 2 shows in Rosemont, which is like 30 minutes outside Chicago. And on a Saturday, 3 shows downtown Zany's, 2 on Sunday. And I think I'll record there. And then this Thursday, I'm going to be in San Diego in La Jolla, California, just running my hour. For my agent, he wants to see it because none of my agents and managers believe that I can build a new hour in a year. I get why they're like, oh, I don't know, man, you're not ready, because, like, you haven't seen it. But that's all I've been working on. I left all my friends in LA, and I became lonely in New York so I could pour myself into stand-up. So if you're in La Jolla, I think the tickets are just like, we're just making it a regular, like, Best of La Jolla night, and I'm just doing an hour, so they're probably pretty cheap, like $8 or something. Come on down this Thursday, the 16th. All right, let's start the episode, huh? I'm going to be in Denver, I'm going to be in Tempe, I'm going to be in Portland. Check out my website, arithegreat.com, for all my dates. And that's it. While you're there at my website, you can find some merchandise. You can go see my tour schedule. But merchandise, also, I have Skeptic Tank t-shirts, and I have, well, the 2014 shirts are coming. I think I found a design. I might do different ones. So if you guys have a cool design for a tour shirt, or a poster, let me know. Maybe I'll use, I'll try to do like an international tour shirt or something. So like I'll have a 2014 shirt, maybe an international one. Ah, whatever. Who cares? So ladies and gentlemen, let's start. Here we go. Ari Shaffir, Skeptic Tank, episode 149, I think. Dr. Doctor with Steve Graham and co-hosted by Jeremy Horn, the guy with more fights in the UFC than almost anybody. You should have seen how much everybody came up to him, all these other UFC fighters. He was just sitting there kind of trying to be, you know, away from the action, and all these guys respect him so much. So here we go, 149, Dr. Doctor with Steve Graham. Let's start.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna kill my head. I got a bad case of loving you.
You know, I think when you actually announce your retirement, it's kind of a, you die inside a little bit.
Oh, really?
Nobody really wants to quit.
Do you get it when GSP's maybe going through?
Oh, absolutely.
Where it's like, it must just be all your time, right?
It is. It's hard. And that's kind of stalled me out and slowed me down for a long time. When all you do is train all day long, you know, training is fun. When you're wrestling, when you're sparring, when you're doing jiu-jitsu, that's all fun.
Yeah.
But when you're up at 6 in the morning and you're running and you're doing all the nasty conditioning and all the physical stuff, that's not fun. Nobody likes to do that.
Yeah.
And when you spend 4 months, you know, to do that, and then you fight and then you get a week off and you start another 4 months for your next fight, that's not fun.
Yeah.
It really makes training miserable.
That's why I think monogamy doesn't work. You just need a break, man. You need a break for a while. Everything.
But yeah, it's real hard.
Wait, how old are you now?
I just turned 38 this year.
Okay, so you took off 36 to 38.
Yep.
Wow.
And the funny thing is, I know a lot of people at 38, you know, it's physically time to retire.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm still as healthy as a 20-year-old.
Oh, Randy.
He's never been injured.
Oh, yeah. In case people look at
it. Yeah, exactly. Right? So it's just... for me, it's just been a lack of like motivation and a lack of time, really. So,
yeah,
slowly starting to get that back.
He just bumped into Anderson Silva's trainer, Bo, and lit another fire on him to start training. And,
yeah,
did you see Cowboy and all them signing autographs and stuff?
No, it is Cerrone. Is he here?
He's by the front entrance. Him and a couple other guys were like, there was this massive line.
Yep.
Do you like that stuff or not at all?
You know, I'm kind of shy by nature.
Yeah, that part would annoy the shit out of me.
So yeah, I mean, I don't really like it, but. On the other hand, I love it because there's nothing better than meeting somebody that enjoys watching what you do and can appreciate it. And I very much appreciate the fans. So
I'd like to meet them. I don't want to have to talk to them.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't want to feel obligated. I want to be like, this is not going anywhere, and just snap and have them be gone.
Yep. Well, that's the thing. You know, when some people, they want to meet you, but they don't really have anything to say.
Oh, right.
You know, it's like, you know.
Rogan had this guy once. He had this guy once. He saw him. We were playing pool, and he kept eyeing him over and over again. You could tell he knew who he was, sort of. But so eventually, he got the courage to go up to him and ask. And he goes, "Like, hey, man, what'd you think of that big fight the other day?" And Joe's like, "Well, which one?" And he goes, "Oh, I don't know." He just wanted something to say.
Yeah, and I get that a lot.
Yeah,
you know what they really want to say is. You know, I'm a huge fan of you. I appreciate what you do. Thank you for entertaining me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I appreciate what you do. But they can't put that into words.
Yeah.
So they stumble around and they try to come up with, you know, like, oh, I saw you fight such and such. How was that?
Yeah, how was that? You know? Need to say something.
Yeah, you don't have to say anything. You can just come up and go, hey, man, I'm a big fan. Thank you. And like, yeah, that's great. I love it.
Bill Simmons said it really well. He's a sports guy. He's a writer for ESPN. He was like, the best case scenario, somebody comes, buys him a beer and says, hey, man, love your work, tips it, and walks away.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, that's not to say I don't want to talk to people. If you have something that's, you know, you actually have a question, absolutely, I'll answer any questions you
got. But they're a stranger. On some level, it's like, I'm talking to a stranger.
Yeah.
How could it be?
But it's funny. I'm only a stranger. They're only a stranger from my perspective.
Oh, right. They really know you.
From their perspective, they know me.
They've known you for years.
So... Yeah.
And he's the least self-promoting person in the entire world. So he looks at some things sometimes saying, you know, I have a hard time, you know, because it's almost promoting myself. And
it feels douchey, right?
It really does. Well, we were just talking about it. I kind of wanted to get pictures with all you guys last night at the show.
Yeah.
But to me, I'm like, yeah, that's, they don't want that.
And Norton wanted to get a picture with you. He was like, what, that was Jeremy Horn? So yeah, he's like, oh, I should get a picture. And then he passed you that last time, and I could see him go, no, not here. Not a casino.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, look at me. I'm with this guy. I'm with that guy. I'm with this guy, you know.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said for self-promoting, because that's, you know, the squeaky.
I had to get talked to when I was starting. Jake Johansson, he would, after shows would end, I would disappear into the corner and be like, where do you go after every show? I'm like, I don't know, just away. I don't want to talk to people. He's like, you have to, man. Well, I'm glad you're here, because I want to talk about being a doctor, about what it's like to be a doctor. And I figure you've been, as soon as he said that, you've been probably to more doctors than anyone I might know.
Ah, no, I'm pretty healthy. I've never really been injured, yeah.
Oh, wow. You don't even go after fights and stuff?
Nope. I mean, every now and then you got a mandatory checkup, you know, cage side. They just look you over, make sure your, you know, your brain's not hanging out of your nose or something. But other than that, yeah, I'm
in over 150 fights. He's never been cut.
Never been cut?
Nope. Nope. He's never been cut, and he's never been knocked out.
Never had a broken bone. Never had anything.
What?
The worst injury I ever had in a fight. I fought Anderson Silva in 2001, I think.
Yeah,
where was that? In Korea, actually.
I definitely was not there for that. Was that in Pride or something?
No, it was a show called Gladiators, You know, a Korean promotion. Tried putting on a show. I think they only did one or two. But like 10 seconds into the first round, I tried to pick him up, and I pulled my groin muscle really bad. The entire inside of my leg was black and blue for like a week after that. But that was it. That was the worst injury I ever had.
What happened to the fight? Over right there?
No. I ended up limping around and getting my ass kicked for three more rounds. And
that's my favorite
thing. He won a pretty lopsided decision. The injury, yeah, a pulled groin muscle was the worst thing I've ever had.
What is it with fighters when you know there's got to be a moment where you sort of know you're not going to win, but they just seem to try to like, I want this to go to a decision?
For me, no.
No?
I mean, I suppose it could happen, but I mean, even in that fight, I just kept thinking, you know, all I got to do is get a hold of him.
Right.
You know, he's dancing around just beating the shit out of me. Ooh, I'm sorry, can I say that? Yeah.
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah, he's beating the crap out of me. I can't get a hold of him. He's, you know, he's so fast.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get a hold of him, but I just kept thinking, man, all I need is one chance. If I can get a hold of him and drag him to the ground,
then you get a shot.
My leg won't matter. I can still submit him.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I suppose there are some points when you're just so far beyond getting abused that, you know you're not going to win. But yeah, and then there is some pride in like, yeah, well, he's
just losing my decision.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not going to finish me. Greg Jackson said that. He said at some point, like midway through the first or second, he'll see one fighter just accept victory and the other accept defeat.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just fighting not to get knocked out or to, you know, yep, whatever is after that. So, doctor.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Steve. So, you gave me great advice on when my knee was all fucked. When I needed to get meniscal surgery.
Can you say that on this?
You can say whatever you want. You can act out a rape if you want. None of that matters here. There's zero rules. You can say
rape jokes are okay.
They're permitted. They're hoped for. Anytime if you want to call for an uprising against the government, that's completely allowed here.
Yeah, I like it.
Whatever you want to do. So I talked to you more and more about just being a doctor and what the realities of it are. And I'm just super interested in it because I don't think anybody really knows, like, day to day what it's like.
No, you're absolutely right. People always are asking me, you know, I'm planning on being a doctor, you know. And I try to actually, in all honesty, dissuade them a little bit.
Do you really?
I do from the bottom of my heart. Then they go, oh, in their minds or sometimes they outwardly just say it. Oh, you're trying to keep that fraternity to yourself, you know. You can keep all that money and all that prestige to yourself. And it is the polar opposite of what the perception is. Absolutely.
There is this perception that, like, they would have an AIDS vaccine, except doctors would make more money on treatment rather than giving the cure. But I'm like, that would mean all doctors would have to be in cahoots.
That's right.
Like, everyone ever.
Well, you know, President Obama said, gee, you know, you go to the doctor with a sore throat, the first thing they want to do is take out your tonsils. Could just give you some medicine to make more money by taking out the tonsils. And
first of all, that's the worst Obama impression I've ever heard in my life. But I like it. So that's noted on this podcast.
Duly noted.
Hey, but so what? That's not the
case. Is further from the truth. In fact, in that particular example, the American Academy of Ear, Nose, and Throat has some very specific guidelines about the number and frequency of streptococcus proven sore throats before you should be taking out anybody's tonsils. It's not like you go there and you have a sore throat. Oh, here's an opportunity to take out some tonsils and make some money. And by the way, the making money thing is so far beyond
You're like a general practitioner, right?
I actually do a few things. Ophthalmology, aerospace medicine, cosmetic facial surgery.
Aerospace medicine?
Yes.
What is that?
That's general medicine for fighter pilots, astronauts, high-performance aviators.
And so you got to do all – and what's the last one?
High-performance aviators.
No, no. What's the three types of –
Oh, cosmetic facial surgery. Okay, okay. I know with a face like mine, it's kind of a – not an intuitive thing that you think that I'd be doing.
You look great.
Yeah.
And so wait, that's all later? For extra money?
No, it's because I kind of get bored easily.
Okay.
I enjoy them. I enjoy – all of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you make as like a general practitioner?
I probably would say probably your average general practitioner makes somewhere between $85,000 and $100,000 a year.
Okay.
And he's got to be really.
It's not mansion money.
Oh, no, no, no. And, you know, the irony is your reimbursement. Well, I can look at it from both perspectives. People think, oh, you're an ophthalmologist. You're going to make a lot more money. And there's a general practitioner. Well, for the same level of visit.
Yeah.
You make the exact same money, you know.
What do you mean?
$29, $39. People, you know, whether on your bill, it might be some large number about what the charge is for that visit. But what the insurance company will pay you, you are compelled to accept. And if you say, oh, yeah, for that visit, my charge is $99. The insurance company says, well, no, we think that it's worth $29, and we'll pay you 80% of that $29, and you collect the remaining 20% from the patient.
And that's... So you have to take that?
It's called the allowable. Yep, you have. If you are contracted with the insurance companies, which virtually you have to be with all the insurance companies,
yeah.
You are compelled to accept their established allowable.
What, by law?
No, by contract. And
all
the insurance companies use as their gold standard to establish those allowable charges Medicare, which is, generally speaking, the lowest paying of all. You know, if you're a brand new patient... and you've never seen the doctor before, and you go for a full exam, it's called a four-level visit. And Medicare might say, gee, you know, we will pay you $75 for that visit. And Blue Cross then says, okay, we'll allow $110 for that visit. And that means if you have signed a contract with them, you can only accept that as – you have to accept that as full payment. You can say, yeah, my fee is $1,000 for that.
And if you accept insurance, this is why.
That's right.
Then you have to. This is why sometimes therapists were just like, I don't take insurance. Because
mm-hmm.
then they'd have to take that lower price.
And the irony is that it requires so much, so many man hours, time, effort, and money to collect money from the insurance companies that maybe a fifth. They'll always deny some claims. In fact, I think it's part of their system that they have to deny X amount of claims because it takes so much time and man hours to appeal that claim and
multiple times.
It costs way much more money to collect what's due to you than it is to let it slide.
Oh.
And so, you know, you have to be seeing people say, well, that doctor spent only 10 minutes with me. And to pay for your overhead, because your income per patient is not great, you have to see lots and lots and lots of patients, more and more each year.
So is that you? And by the way, if you want to add anything, just jump in.
Now, this is all really interesting. I didn't realize it was...
So is that you saying I need to see a lot more patients to make your nut,
no,
or is that the hospital you work at?
No, in private practice, each individual physician has to. And another irony is that, well, for example, ophthalmology, eye surgery, is the specialty in which you as the doctor have to purchase more extremely sophisticated and gets outdated yearly equipment to have in your office. You have to have very sophisticated cosmic equipment, and much of which insurance doesn't reimburse you for getting.
But won't reimburse you. Then you just have to eat it?
You have to eat it in order to be practicing up to the standard of the community. The medical standard of the community, you need to use that, but you don't get reimbursed for it. So much of it, it comes out of your pocket to buy
You're seeing patients for free,
and then after 3 or 4 years, that piece of equipment is obsolete.
Outdated.
And there are other specialties like, you know, people's orthopedic surgery, for example, or even more so, psychiatry. You get paid the same thing for that four-level visit. Psychiatrist just has to have a chair, and himself usually keeps his own schedule.
Yeah.
An orthopedic surgeon, He doesn't have to buy any equipment. The hospital owns the equipment. He wants you to send you for an MRI or a CAT scan and writes you an order for that, and you go to the imaging center and get it. He needs really no overhead in his office.
Do you have to pay to be in that, to use that equipment? To use the hospital's equipment?
Well, no, you don't have to pay the hospital. The hospital actually bills the patient separately for it.
Oh, yeah. That's why you get a fucking bill for to anesthetize you upstairs
and then
surgery downstairs.
You'll get multiple. If you have a surgery, there'll be the surgeon's fee. There'll be the hospital fee. There'll be the
operating room fee. Separate deductibles. I was always like, what are you talking about?
There'll be the equipment fee. There'll be the anesthesiology fee. So there'll be many different charges.
Yeah.
And, you know, the surgeon's fee is a relatively small percentage of that total charge. And, you know, again, it's one of the specialties that, or one of the professions that, for example, I tell people, if you were to want to go to business school, and the business school said, well, it's part of your application, write up a business plan for us. It's part of, you know, we'll see how you do.
Okay.
And you write, well, I want to be in a business where it doesn't matter how good or how bad you are, you'll be paid the same thing. And you have no idea when you'll be collecting that. And regardless of how many surgeries or visits you see, you can't predict what your pay will be. And you have to see more and more each year to pay your overhead. And the overhead goes up with the cost of living, which
because rents go up.
And reimbursement to the doctor, pay to the doctor, goes down rapidly.
Why?
Obviously,
why does it go down?
Because reimbursement goes down pretty much every year. For example, cataract surgery. In the year 1986,
okay,
the surgeon's fee, Medicare, the lowest payer, was paying about $1,100 or $1,200 for a cataract operation. And it was done by a relatively simple technique, no cosmic instrumentation that you needed. Now you have to have extremely cosmic instrumentation, and what you get paid by Medicare is $610.
Instead of $1,100
or $1,200. And for that $610, it's called a global fee, meaning for the next 90 days or 3 months, every time you see that patient, you don't charge the patient.
Because you've already charged them?
You've already charged them. And if it's related to the surgery in any way, you can't charge them. But again, as I was saying before, insurance companies will try to mess with you a little bit. And a person might say they scratch their eye by walking into a door, and you operated on that eye 2.5 months ago, and they'll come in for you, and you put a little code on it saying, hey, this is a separate and identifiable problem from the surgery, and you submit it to the insurance company, and they'll decline it and say, oh, no, you know, you're in the 90-day period. So you got to appeal it, but the appeal, you know, is going to take so much time, effort, and cost you so much.
Does the insurance company make more by charging? Wouldn't they make – okay. Oh, so the individual person, the patient, mm-hmm, just pays the insurance company a certain amount per year.
That's right.
And so the insurance company used to pay you then $1,200.
That's
and
right.
Now they're only paying you $600.
That's right.
And they're charging the customer the same amount.
No, well, the customer pays his monthly premium, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
Different insurance plans will cover different amounts. You know, they'll say some will cover 50%, some cover 80%, some cover 90%. Some rare ones, like the politicians have, will cover 100%.
They have the best ones.
Oh, by far. They voted to themselves.
Yeah.
And the government employees also have tremendous insurance. That's called R. There's a letter R in front of their insurance number. And that means it's for the government employees. They pay like $100 deductible each year, and it covers basically 100%. You can't get that insurance unless you work for the government.
Fucking government. You know, they had this law that they were allowed to insider trade up until like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
They could insider trade. And then some new congressman saw it, and he was like, hey, what the fuck? That's not fair. Why are we the only ones allowed? So he changed the law. He like passed a bill like they can't do it anymore. And then 2 years later, they're allowed to again.
Well, you can vote themselves anything they want to vote, you know? Hey, let's vote ourselves a pay increase. Well, why not?
Sure. I would.
Yeah. Who wouldn't?
I would. Of course I would. I'm like, hey, let's just get more.
And for all you politicos out there, I have the answer to all of government's problems.
What?
And I don't know why it's not talked about more. Everyone, every single politician, term limit, once. Like George Washington said, from the plow to the office, back to the plow. No lifetime politicians. If you didn't have to get reelected, all the incentives for
one term, no matter what.
One term. President, 6 years, Congress, whatever. One term. You're in, you're
make
out.
A term's a different amount of time.
Then doesn't matter what people will say. Hey, I'll give you $10,000, $100,000 for your next election. Doesn't matter. I'm not going to get elected.
Yeah.
I can't run.
Yeah. My friend Steve Simone said he'll always vote against the incumbent because he's like, whoever was just in office didn't change it. Didn't change the system. Yeah. So it's like, you're out. I'm just voting you out.
I believe every single politician should be in there for one term. That's and then good... back to his original job, just like the founding fathers envisioned.
You told me once, which I thought was interesting. I like to think of people in terms of like real humans in a job. Like when people like saw GSP retire, like, oh, must be something must be going on in his life. And I'm like, well, can't he just be a guy who's at 30, whatever he is, 35 years old, and just wants to go skiing for like 2 months and like just wants to live his life a little bit? Can't that? We're real humans in this position.
Yep.
You know, when people are like, oh, you have a better chance to win a championship at the Knicks or whatever it is. Like, but maybe you want your children to have friends.
And he's been
in Kansas.
He's been at the top for how many years has he been champion? Seven or more? And to do that same routine, not just like, you know, one of the average fighters, but to be the champion and everybody, the best people in the world challenging you constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than just, you know, the average.
Yeah, you're a person doing that job.
Yeah.
And so you told me once about you do like, didn't they have you in Utah doing like 12-hour shifts? Or maybe it was before Utah.
Oh, no, that was in Phoenix.
Phoenix, okay.
In urgent care, yeah.
And
no, it was more like 13-hour shifts.
13-hour shifts.
Yeah.
What, a little break?
No break.
No break.
Nothing scheduled for a break.
Though. And I asked you, I was like, well, the care you give your patients at hour 12 must be far worse
way
than hour 1.
Way different than hour 1, yes. Way, way different. And it's just an absolute fact. You cannot be different. You cannot be the same, I should say, at hour 13 than you were at hour 1.
Any person.
It's impossible.
But there's this theory that, like, doctors are pure and they know their job, they know what they're doing, and they'll always give you the best care they can.
We give you the best care we can, but the best care at hour 13, the best you can muster up no matter what. I mean, imagine yourself. What are you doing at hour 13 compared to hour 1?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it just is a fact. And, now, the pay is such for doctors that you have to work those hours. And urgent care, you know, they open at 8 a.m. and the doors close at 8 p.m. And about 5 or 10 minutes before 8 p.m. comes, it's as if a bus unloaded in front of the office. This huge stream of patients rushes in the door. And while 8 o'clock, the door gets locked. But now you have like 6 or 8 or 10 more patients in the waiting room at 8 o'clock. So,
wow.
You wouldn't have to do 13-hour days if people didn't go to the emergency room with a headache.
Oh, yeah.
The things that you can't.
How much does that bother you?
Oh.
Those waters.
It bothers me. I will be highly politically incorrect here.
Okay, go for it.
The abuse of insurance is something that.
By patients?
Yes. Something that defies description. A little bit off track. You know, because you're provided insurance, does not mean that you get health care.
Explain that.
For example, different policies will pay so badly that doctors can't afford to take it. If you took that policy, accepted those payments, you'd run yourself out of business. You can't cover your overhead. So in Arizona, it's called Access. In other places, it's the state's version of Medicaid. They pay so little that if you saw many of those patients, you'd be out of business.
Why? Because you have to give them a certain...
Well, your reimbursement is $29, first of all. And they say that you have the right to choose your physician. And this, I swear on my mom, a couple of patients would come from... the cab fare to the office was $103. The cab fare back from the office is $103. Which gets paid for by Access.
Oh, what?
Yes. And the doctor makes $29 for the visit.
Wow, cabbies are making more than you.
Way more. And if there is no taxi cab available,
yeah.
You check this out. Look it up if you think I'm making this up.
What?
EMTs will have to pick you up and bring you. So, yeah.
For your headache.
Pardon?
For your headache.
Well, not even for that. I mean, instance.
Just because somebody's like, no, I'm going to see the doctor.
For example, you know, and people will go to urgent cares because you don't have to make an appointment, but it's really horrible ongoing medical care because you don't see the same doctor twice, and they're seeing you in a whole different environment that's really established for kind of urgent care, not routine medical care. Someone will come, a mother with her three daughters, and say, well, or three children, we were in a room a few weeks ago with someone who had the flu. We want to be checked out for the flu. What do you say?
Can't say no.
How you feeling? You know,
right?
Patients will come in and
should that be just general practice? Should they be saying like, well, if somebody wants a checkup or wants to be like, I just want to make sure everything's going okay.
Well, then they should be seeing a general doctor, not
general
an urgent
doctor.
Care.
Okay.
Yeah. You should look in the mirror and go, do I feel okay? Yes, there's no problem.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, but the abuse of the system, for example, there's another girl I can remember. She was vacationing in Hawaii as an access patient, Medicaid patient, financially strapped patient. Came to see me because she had maybe a dime-sized, most superficial abrasion on the inside of her upper arm from carrying her surfboard.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, I just came in to make sure this isn't going to get infected. You know, I mean, in a million years, I mean, you would be humiliated to let any of your friends know that you ever went to see a doctor for some of the stuff that comes in, and it's not just occasional.
So how do they fix that?
It looks fine. It's going
to
be
fine.
But
how do you get
how do you
people
fix
to, not,
that?
To not come
you know,
to not come and bother people?
Make them pay for it themselves? But,
well, that's because the access program, Medicaid program, requires that you pay up to a $5 voluntary copay when you come to see the doctor.
Okay, it's nothing.
And to my best of my honest knowledge, I don't ever remember any patient ever paying it. But they will come and sit in the room with their $6 Starbucks latte as they're telling you about a problem which is so minuscule that, as I said, if you told any of your friends that you went to a doctor for that, they'd look at you like, oh, dude, what are you doing? You know, and that just goes on and on and on. So they came in this cab for $206 round trip, drinking their latte, not paying the $5 copay, and you're here for a little scratch. And, hey, while I'm here, can you write me a prescription for 100, 800 milligram ibuprofens? I said, well, what do you need that for? You're here for something else. Well, that way I can have it around the house in case I need it because it's free, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I say, uh-uh. Someone else needs the money. That would. Well, because someone's paying for that. You're paying for
the prescription.
The prescription. I mean, your taxes. They're draining the system to get medicines to have at home just in case there's something they might need it for in the future.
How often do people come in looking for, like, Xanax and, like, party drugs?
All the time. Well, narcotics. Things like oxycodone, hydrocodone, and other stuff. And they are the worst of all the patients because they are the most manipulative and volatile. They will do anything.
They come in for a reason.
Oh, yeah.
To get that thing.
For that. I have constant back pain. My doctor's out of town, and there's nobody covering for him, and I can't exist. You know, well, what am I going to do? I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
I'm really hard-nosed on that for many patients.
You won't do it. You won't, like.
Unless there's some verifiable, and they'll come in with stories that are, sometimes they're not too bright. They're just impossible. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like sometimes the doctors doubt me.
Yeah.
When I was going in, when I had that problem with my leg, it was like, they look at me, I was like, dude, I need something for this pain. It's horrible. And they're like,
But when they come in obtunded, like, so over, I can't take this pain anymore, and nobody's paying me any attention. It's like, You know, I mean, there's not too much of a question there. And then, I mean, this happened to me once. Unfortunately, there's another person in the room with me. They left the room screaming and yelling, cursing at me. And he assaulted me. He assaulted me. That doctor in there assaulted me.
Wow.
You know, it's because they're really sometimes not too stable.
I have this theory that, you know how when a lion is attacking a gazelle or a deer or something, when it catches them, the last thing a deer can do is like kick a little bit. It's like his last hold on to life. You know, it's like, I got nothing else. Maybe this will work. And they'll just kick and hopefully hit him in the head. Drama queens and drug addicts, the same thing. They're like, well, if this isn't leading to what I need, then, well, fuck you, he touched me.
That's right.
He touched my dick. Right. It's like something. I got to do something.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I mean, there are some, I don't want to paint it that medicine is horrible.
Yeah.
And maybe I sound that way. No, medicine at times can be very rewarding.
Explain.
Less and less so in the U.S. People have hugely unrealistic expectations of what medicine can do, and they take it unbelievably for granted. You know, you can really bust your butt, do a magnificent job on them that, you know, it's exquisite, and they'll either say, you know, the word thank you doesn't really exist, or, well, how come this is still like that, or how come this, you know, you, for example, you LASIK, you know, people in other countries, third world countries, can't even think of that. But, you know, you'll take a person who is 2,800. the big E, if you brought it to half the distance, they could barely make out the big E. That's 2,800.
What does that mean?
Well, you an eye chart that you're in the eye doctor's office. You look at the big E.
800.
Oh.
That's a 2,400 letter.
Okay.
If it's a 20 feet, that big E is 2,400. If you brought it halfway closer to the patient and they could just barely make it out, then their vision would be 2,800.
Okay.
You can take that person and do LASIK on them and then make them 20/20.
Yeah.
Now, if that patient had his best or her best glasses on, they could see a little bit better than 20/20, like 20/15, you know.
Yeah.
But now they're 2,800 to 20/20 with no glasses, and they go, oh, I can't live like this. I'm blind. I can't see. Like, if I had known it was going to be this bad, I would never have had this done.
Put it back.
Yeah, it's like, you know.
Unlasik it.
Yeah. You know,
wow, they want you to be like a plumber. Like, just fix it the way I want it to be fixed.
Yeah, I mean, their expectation, you explain to them, this is, for example, to give you functional vision, to be able to do many, if not most, things without glasses, some things you might need glasses for. And you even surpass that expectation by giving them 20/20, which is as good as I can possibly see with my own eyeglasses on. And that's not what I expected. That's a lot, you know. But I mean, there are some people who, you know, you have changed their lives. That makes it all worthwhile.
Just pluck their eyeball right out of their head.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, how do you feel? Like that.
Get out of here.
Is that better?
How do you pay back $50,000 or $100,000 worth of?
Or $130,000. Well, it's much more now. When I
medical school,
I graduated.
How do you pay that back at $30 a pop?
That's exactly the problem now. I mean, I graduated medical school in 1985. I paid for my own. I took loans and got scholarships from my own private college. I went to optometry school, another doctorate for 4 more years. Then I went to medical school for 4 years. All of them private schools. That's how it happened. So I had about $130,000 to pay back in old dollars. The interest rate on one of them was called a HEAL loan, Health Education Assistance Loan. Interest rate was 21%, and the interest began to tick the minute they distributed the loan to you, not 6 months after you graduate. So I had this gigantic. It was only about 5 or 6 years ago that I was able to, in a manner of speaking, pay off all those loans by folding them into some home equity lines of credit that I had and pay them off that way.
Are you out now?
Now I'm out.
I just finished my college loans. Yeah. Like last year.
Yeah.
They give you a little email, and I was like, fuck yeah. No, I'm under the thumb.
Free at last.
Yeah. I'm like, I am 30. I think I was 38. I'm like, now I graduated at 23. 15 more years spending up.
Now,
for 4 years.
School is exponentially more expensive.
Yeah.
Exponentially more expensive than it was then, and reimbursement, likewise, is virtually exponentially smaller than it was back then. So the gap between what it's going to cost you to arrive at your endpoint and how you're going to wind up paying that back is, I don't see how a person can really crack that nut, so to speak.
When is it rewarding, emotionally?
For me?
Yeah.
No kidding. When someone says thank you.
Really?
Honest to God. It's that simple.
When it's like a heartfelt, like, wow, man, thanks.
Or anything. Just even thank you. I mean, it doesn't have to be just the word thank you that at least is meant. But some people, that you know, the word please and thank you escapes society these days. But it's I guess if you're a certain level of perfectionist and you do your absolute best for someone, you give it your heart and soul, and someone doesn't really appreciate it.
Yeah.
For me particularly, that gets to me because I really try to put myself into it. And
they just leave.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, okay, just, you know, I expected that. That's, you know, it's expectations.
Yeah.
You know,
it's nothing extra.
Yeah.
Man, have you ever, I got a bunch of questions. Have you ever lost somebody?
In medical school. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And an internship.
How do you deal with it? And what happened?
Well, you just have to. I mean, you don't have a choice. You have to kind of objectify yourself. To say that you can't attach yourself personally, that's definitely true, but you still do get attached somewhat personally because you're investing your best efforts into it, and you know it might be a losing battle. But someone, it's just their time to go, and pretty much nothing that you can do will have helped them.
Can you second-guess yourself, though? Like, maybe if I had done this?
All the time. You know,
I can do that with comedy, but there's no real repercussions. It's just not getting a laugh.
Right.
I was like, I should have not done that last tagline. It's too big a room.
Well, you know,
no big deal.
In internship in particular, you know, you're in a hospital-based setting. You have really sick people, and some of them have had heart attacks or on the verge of having heart attacks or strokes or other such thing. And you wonder, gee, did I have them on the right combination of things? Did I have the appropriate tests done that I could have seen this coming in advance? And you always second-guess yourself. And, you know, there are always things you could have done better in retrospect because you have the information in retrospect. But doing your best in prospect, you know, prospectively, it just isn't the same. You don't have all that data to look backwards on.
Does it keep you up?
It did. Yeah. You know, bit by bit, you have to more and more objectify yourself, be much more objective. And not to say you can't invest your soul into it, but you, in your mind, you have to really compartmentalize the job from the emotions. It's kind of like flying an airplane. If you let your battle with your girlfriend or whatever going on when you're flying your plane, you'll become a smoking hole. The same thing if you're doing surgery. You think, oh man, you know, this is my daughter's pregnant. They're repossessing my house. My dog just died. You know, and you're doing a surgery. You're going to screw that patient up.
Oh,
so you
right.
have to really become oh,
yeah,
a great
you got more work to do.
Yeah, yeah. You have to be a great compartmentalizer.
So is it with compartmentalization, is it different than when you lose like an acquaintance of yours as opposed to a patient?
Oh, entirely different. You're usually not taking care of your acquaintance, usually. If I would recuse myself from taking care of someone I really knew who was really sick.
No, I mean, let's just say someone in your life passed.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
you know what I mean? Is that a different way than a patient passing?
Yeah, is a feeling.
Different? Yeah.
Oh yeah, you know, family member. It's a whole different kind of an attachment. You know, my mom, my dad, my other relatives. You know, it's, yeah, that's a pain that's you know nothing else equates to that.
Do they prepare you at all, like psychologically, in medical school for that?
It's a matter of a little bit of desensitization at first. You know, they tell you, they try to teach you, that you have courses on it, but that's all just. You know, paperwork. When it comes right down to it, it just takes some experience going through it.
Do it a bunch, and then
you learn how to deal with it a little bit at a time, and hopefully, when you get done with the whole process, you have the right amount of compartmentalization, not to make yourself an automaton. Some folks just plain automatons, and you talk to them, they go, you're right off the bat, know that. You know, maybe I wish you were a little bit more invested in this.
I have this theory about abortion doctors, or like. They said some abortion. It was like 2 years ago. Someone in Alabama, they killed him, an abortion doctor.
And
first of all, they're still doing that.
I remember that.
Yeah, but then my thought was everyone was saying how like they're completely innocent. You know, they're just doctors. And I'm like, they're not completely innocent.
Now, some yes, some no.
They are still doing abortions all day.
There are some doctors that don't have a lot of scruples, just like everyone else. There's some bad cops. There's some bad military. Yeah. There's some bad everything. You know, in the world, you can't weed them all out. And if you're just doing, you know, all the thing you're doing is late-term abortions or pithing the baby after he's born alive, you kill the baby. So
it's like put your finger over his...
Basically, you put a needle in the back of their head to scramble their brain a bit.
That's how they killed the aliens in X-Files.
Yeah.
Oh, that's how they kill abortions, too?
Yeah, late-term abortions.
Oh.
Yeah. Because the fetus is alive when it's, you know, when it's delivered.
But, I mean, you can't just completely be like, as you're pulling out what looks like a little baby, you can't just be like, ho-hum, what should we do for lunch today? Like, that's got to affect you a little bit, right? You've got to take some of that home with you.
Well, I delivered about 10 babies in my internship, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun.
What's that feeling like?
That's kind of a lot of fun, you know.
Guiding a baby out into life?
That's exactly what you do. You're kind of guiding it and freeing up things that seem to get caught if you can.
Yeah.
And then sewing things up if they need to be sewn up. You know, people delivered babies for how many millennia without the help of doctors. So it's icing on the cake.
Oh, yeah, I guess so, right? People used to just do it.
Yeah.
Just pop out a baby. I guess moms would always die.
I went to medical school in Miami, and at that time was the second largest OB, obstetrics department in the country, after L.A. County General. And there were distinct groups of people who would be giving birth. There were the Haitians from Haiti. There were the Seminole Indians, and there were the Cubans.
Cubans, yeah.
And each, as you walked down the hall, you knew which ethnic group was giving birth because there was ITAC, which is ay-ay-ay-ay-ay-ay-ay, and there was whooping, whoop, whoop, whoop. And the ITAC.
Oh, really? That's how they would do it?
Yep. The ITAC.
What's ITAC?
That's the Cubans. Ay, 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 ay. And then the whooping is the Haitians. Woo, woo, woo.
They just knew how to breathe that way?
Yep. And then there's the Seminole Indians, which is
They just took it.
No noise. You didn't know. It just, eh.
What do you do when you see bad doctors? You must, right? If it's good doctors,
yeah,
I don't, there must be bad ones.
I don't want to say that I try to point them out, but I'll do my best to if I think the doctor isn't doing the best for a patient, let the patient get a good feeling that I think they might be getting better care for this problem elsewhere. I don't say, that guy sucks.
Right.
I try to say, well, I think for your particular instance, you'd be better served, and I might make a couple of other recommendations.
Yeah. Somebody, I had this problem when my commercial agent, who I was friends with, would ask mm-hmm. me about comics, like, is this guy funny or not? And my first thought was like, no, you got to protect comedians. But then my second thought was like, I'm friends with my commercial agent. I barely know that comic, and he's not funny. And I'm going to fuck you over by saying, sign some guy who's completely not funny.
Hey, you're going to go to, I'm going to spend money on a ticket to see him?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So then it's like, just, yeah, I should give honest opinions and say, nah, that guy's not very good.
I try to do that,
please
too.
Don't tell him I said that.
You know? Yeah.
I don't need the drama, but please, but you should go somewhere else.
Yeah, I try to do the same best as nicely as I can. Sometimes things appear so egregious, and not just on a single occasion. Anything can happen crazily once, but if I see kind of a pattern, sometimes I get so, I guess, what? Whacked out. It
must
affects
frustrate
me
you.
So much that I think, you know, this fella, I don't think is doing you very well. You know, he's not doing a very good job for you. I will specifically point that out rather than just subtly recommend a different person.
Do those doctors get pushed out, or do they just stay in the vault?
It's hard to
forever.
Know. You know, when people think what people think makes a good doctor is different than necessarily what makes a good doctor. If the guy is sitting there, he talks to you a lot, he's an affable person, he listens to you, which is important,
yeah,
that makes him a good doctor. He might be a horrible hack, he might be the village idiot, but if he's a nice guy, listens to you,
and you feel good being around him,
yeah, and that has,
dude, that's a lot of it.
That has a lot to do. I mean, to make the patient feel good is part of what a doctor is supposed to do. But if a person has a significant problem, sometimes they might not get the best care from that guy or that gal, and then it's difficult to suggest to them going elsewhere because they've established this close relationship with someone who might not be the best for them.
Oh, so right.
That's complicated.
I had I got chlamydia once.
You?
Yeah.
No.
Believe it or not.
Sitting on a toilet seat in the airport?
That's what I think it was. But, like, there's a way doctors can treat you with that. Where, like, it's the first time I go through it. I have no idea what mm-hmm. this is and if I'm a horrible person, if this ever go away. And there's one doctor that's just like, well, here it is. Take this. That's what you got. And they just make you feel like an asshole. And then there's another type of doctor be like, hey, man, it's bad. You should take this as a warning, but it's not the end of the world. This will go away. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, just, you know what I mean? There's just a nicer way to handle
there
it.
There is.
Where it makes me feel better.
But remember that 13th hour?
Uh-huh.
Well.
Oh.
Yeah. At the end of the day, after you've first seen, you know, a third of your patients who are just there for absolutely frivolous reasons, and today you've seen X number of people who have similar kind of problems, you kind of go, look. You say, this is the most common venereal disease, you know, oftentimes doesn't present in men, usually presents in women more quickly, take some azithromycin, one big dose one day, you're done, it'll be cured, be a lot more careful, use protection. You know, you can say that a number of different ways, depending how beaten down you are at the end of the day.
Right.
So
I got to keep taking that into account. So I should go early morning. That's when you should do your...
And personally, you know, as the day goes on, I degrade rapidly. You know, up until around 1 o'clock, I am on it. Time 4 or 5 comes, and if I were to be working 13 or 14 hour shifts, those last couple hours, I'm just doing my best to hang on. You know, all you can think of is this has got to end soon. You know, I'm not looking forward to seeing that room full of patients out in the waiting room. I just can't wait to see them.
I gotta stop going late in the afternoon.
It's unrealistic. Yeah,
is that when you do it?
The more embarrassing your condition, the earlier in the day you should go.
Yeah. It's like, I want to be the first one to be anything like this. Yeah.
Maybe bring him a coffee or something in the morning.
Yeah. You know, I once offered my doctor tickets to the Comedy Store, and I thought, is this wrong? Should I not be doing this? But then he's like, oh, cool, man. Thanks. I love comedy. I'll bring my wife.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, you're allowed.
That brings up another subject. You know, people think, oh, yeah, you know, the drug companies, you know,
yeah,
they can influence doctors
that.
And all that.
Uh-huh.
You know, up to about 10 years ago, even a little bit more than that, that could have been the case. They used to pay for you to go to academy meetings and pay for your fare there.
In Hawaii or something?
Yeah, okay. And bring you all kinds of different gifts. Now, they can't even bring you pens or sticky pads.
Legally?
Yeah, that's too much influence.
Because of the pushback?
Yeah.
Was the influence a problem?
I can see where it may have been about 20 years ago. You know, yes, it was. But not in the last 15 years for sure. I mean, the drug companies are regulated with respect to that so tightly. They can't bring you pens with their name on it. They can't bring you sticky pads.
They can't do that anymore.
They can't bring you out for lunch, you know. They can occasionally bring some, like, donuts to the office, you know, for the whole office, or some, you know, candy for the office, but nothing.
And that's it. Cookies,
yeah, nothing of real value. Yeah, cookies, exactly.
Just so you're like, I like that guy. I like Margaret.
Right.
She's always cool.
Right.
And then maybe you'll be like, yeah, let's use her.
They'll keep their name in front of you.
Uh-huh.
You know, but think when Pfizer now takes you to Vegas for the American Academy of Ophthalmology and wines and dines you and parties, brings you to parties and pays for everything in the world and. Yeah, those days are
gone.
Way,
yeah, that was
way gone.
I put it out to Twitter, like, do you have any legit questions for a doc? Like, something you really wanted to know. Huh. And that was probably the number one thing.
Yeah.
Like, how do you keep the money out of our pharmaceuticals from paying you off?
It is not there. There is very little influence. And when different studies are done, a doctor has to declare and fill out a form. And it has to be in the study itself stating that he has a financial interest in the company that makes the drug that they're...
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Here, move this closer to your face.
They have to have a financial interest. They do have a financial interest.
They have to
in the company whose drug they're involved in.
That seems right, though.
Yeah. Oh, it is right.
You should be, and like, open your books.
And when that occurs, you have to weigh that in terms of how much validity you give to the study.
Right.
You know, and it may not have any input whatsoever. The doctor may be completely 100% objective. On the other hand, you can't say that for sure. So it kind of takes away from the evidence-based medicine. Yeah.
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 So how did the drug companies end? Is it commercials where they say, ask your doctor about Abilify or whatever the drug is?
That's to cover their butts, yeah. And they want to establish the name of the medicine in your mind by repetition that, you know, patients will come in and they'll say, I saw this on TV. I have this disease. I want this medicine.
And then do you give it to them?
No.
Or you're more likely to give it to them?
No. It's. I usually say, well, number one, let's determine if you really do have this problem. Because every patient knows. Either they know because they saw it on TV or they've been on the internet and they know what their problem is. And if you tell them that it's not, then you, the doctor, don't know what you're talking about. Because
they
researched a lot of it on the internet. They know from researching on the internet, and they also know what the best treatment for it is. So if they actually have that problem, but that is not going to be the best treatment for them.
It's even harder.
Yeah. Oh, then it's like, I saw this, or I know, I researched that too, you know.
How often do people, like, can you tell they think you're an idiot?
Probably the majority of the time.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
Some people aren't too good at disguising it. They may try.
Do people lie to you a lot?
All the time.
I finally got over that. Where
cardinal,
I was like,
rule.
Yeah, I finally got over that. I was like, wait, this is the guy who's supposed to be helping me.
Yeah.
I need him to know what I'm doing.
Cardinal rule, patients will lie all the time.
No, don't smoke, probably. That's the number one.
And even more than that, they will sometimes magnify their symptoms or add symptoms.
Because they want you to go down this road.
They want you to pay more attention. Like, you'll see them for something relatively simple but valid, and you'll ask them a bunch of questions, pertinent negatives. Well, have you at the same time had this? Nausea, vomiting, dizziness, you know, faintness. I have some of that. Yeah, I have some of that too. Uh-huh, yeah, I have some of that too. And pretty soon you say, everything I'm asking, pretty much, they all say, yeah, I got some of that. And, you know.
Because they think you're asking that this means you have this disease, so they want to say yes?
Yeah, or they believe that you'll somehow be a deeper investigator if they present all these things to you, but they're really detracting from it because, you know, the major part of medicine for diagnosis, you're familiar with diseases, you're familiar with their symptoms and the different ways they can appear, and when the person starts padding their symptom list, so to speak, then it it detracts from their ability, from the doctor's ability to make an accurate diagnosis.
Right.
So, well, they think that it's going to make you pay them that much more attention. It really winds up to not help them out at all. It makes things more, I should say, less effective for them.
Yeah. You never go to doctors for real?
No.
How is that possible?
I was living back in Iowa one time, and I got bit. I was up in my attic. I was installing a ceiling fan, so I was up in my attic digging around in the insulation, and I got bit by something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was. My arm swelled up. I got bit right on my forearm here. Kind of still see the scar, but my arm swelled up to twice the size of it, so my girlfriend finally made me go to the doctor. So he looks at it, and he's like, I'm not sure what's going on there, but you've got some kind of nasty infection going there. So he cut my arm open, and it exploded. And it apparently was a brown recluse spider or something.
Oh, really?
Like that. Yeah. And then I found out that generally most people, when they get bit by a spider, are dead after a couple of days. And I finally went to the doctor after a week.
What, your redneck genes kept you going?
I guess. I don't know. So he squeezed a ton of pus out of it, and when it was all said and done, I could stick two knuckles of my pinky finger into the hole it left in my arm.
Wow.
It was a huge gap in my arm.
Did he pack it full of gauze?
Yep, yeah. Packed it full of gauze, and this is what's really funny. I kind of think I'm superhuman because of this, but I don't know.
Well, you are. Everyone knows that.
So, yeah. So he packs it full of gauze, and he's like, okay, we need to schedule you a surgery. Because this was, the pocket left in my arm was about as big as a golf ball. It was huge. And he said, what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to cut off, you know, the surface tissue, and then we're going to have to do a skin graft because I've got a huge divot in my arm now.
Yeah.
And, of course, I don't have insurance. I'm like, nope, that's expensive.
You don't have insurance?
I didn't then. I do now, but I still don't use it. This was 10 years, 12 years ago.
Okay.
And so I'm like, look, I can't afford that. I don't want to do it. It's clean. Let's just see how it heals. And he's like, okay, we can wait. But you're going to have to get surgery, so we'll schedule another appointment for you to come back in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, I came back, and the hole had closed so completely that I had a Band-Aid on it with nothing else.
Oh, wow.
All of the – I had to change it, you know, daily, a couple times a day. I'd pack more tissue into it. It started, I would take a piece of gauze that was about 2 feet long, take a Q-tip and jam all of it in there.
Yeah,
it was bad. And by 2 weeks later when I went back, I couldn't get any gauze in there. It had almost completely closed up. Now it's just a little scar on my arm. I don't know.
I can't really see it.
Maybe that is superior genetics.
The other arm.
Yeah.
That's how well it closed up.
Yeah, that little dark spot right there, I think, is what it was.
Do you ever get grossed out by things like that, Doc?
Only when they spatter me in the face.
Yeah.
There are some, you know, it's called an IND, an incision and drainage. When you get a pocket-filled pus, pus, and the only way, you know, antibiotics by mouth will not take care of an abscess. That's called an abscess. You can give all the antibiotic in the world by intravenous, by mouth. It will not take care of it. You have to open it up and express all the pus and then pack it with either iodine-soaked gauze.
To keep the pus from filling back up?
It helps to also prevent infection, but exactly right. It'll keep more ooze from filling in that space. And it encourages what's called granulation, filling in of that big divot. Where was I going with that?
How disgusting it is when it splatters your face.
Well, sometimes, you know, you will just, you'll numb the area up as best you can, and you'll stick the scalpel blade into it, and the thing basically explodes. And it can squirt across the room, and it smells so fetid. I mean, it's a smell almost as bad as the smell of death. But it is horrific. And sometimes this stuff...
This is cool.
So, and that's basically what it was. So I go in. There's a table on there. He has me lay down on this table face down. And it was my right arm because I was laying on this side. And he's sitting at a table right where my hand is. And he cuts it open. And the wall was right about where Doc was. When he cut it open, it splattered like somebody had taken a handful of paper towels and dipped them in water and thrown it against the wall.
Wow.
It splattered like a paintball. And then he squeezed out a bunch more.
Yep.
It was huge.
There are three videos that I've seen online that I couldn't stomach. There's the beheading of that Jewish journalist. Remember that?
Yeah.
And they chopped his head, but they didn't chop it right off. It went like a couple inches into his head, and then he's like screaming, and slowly the life drains out of him. I couldn't watch that a second time. The horse video where the horse fucks the guy to death. I watched that once, tried to watch it again, and then I was like, I was too, and there was one compilation video of them taking abscesses and just like letting the pus drain out, and there was another one I just have to turn off.
Like, honestly, maybe my perspective is off, but it's certainly gross to see.
Yeah, but from your perspective, it's hilarious, right?
Well, like, to me, it's like cleansing. You watch all that pus drain out, and to me, I'm like, yes, you're getting all that filth out of there. You're going to have a nice, clean, you know, area after that. So to me, it's like, it's
and the pain goes away almost instantaneously.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, like popping a blackhead times 1,000. That joy you get from seeing that all that
gunk is getting out of there. Now you're going to clean it up. It's going to be nice, clean, pink flesh. It's going to get back to healing. I mean, to me, that's appealing.
All that pressure is
what caused pain. And I had no idea how much pressure was in my arm until he cut it and drained it. It was night and day.
Oh, really? You could feel it?
Oh, man. And I didn't realize it had built up over, you know, a couple of weeks.
I had staff once. It was sort of the same thing.
Yeah,
pressure builds up.
Yep.
Oh. Imagine, if you will, you get that exact same thing in your perineum. In other words, between your scrotum and your rectum.
Ooh.
Or your ball sack and asshole.
People
get them there?
Oh, yeah. And it is so exquisitely tender. I mean, it is so tender that you can't even come near to anesthetizing it to incise it. And those people have to go get some conscious sedation or even light general anesthesia in order to incise it, because it is so painful.
I remember I had no insurance. I had a staph infection. And Rogan, we were playing pool, and I was limping. Rogan's like, what's the matter? I'm like, I had a spider bite or something. Not once at 10th Planet. Not one picture of this is what staph looks like. Just in case you get it, you should seek help. Not one picture. Just, well, you'll know.
Yeah.
And so he's like, let me see the spider bite. And I showed up, like, dude, you have to go to the hospital right now. That is bad stuff. How long you had them? Like, a few weeks? He's like, go now. And so without insurance, I went. And they're like, it's going to cost this much. I'm like, oh, I'll go tomorrow. I can't afford this, so I'll take the chance. But the doctor was like, okay, I have to put a needle in there. And I'm like, is this going to hurt? He goes, no. I'm like, wait. It hurts if I just touch it with my pinky.
Oh, it hurts.
And he goes, it's absolutely going to hurt. I was lying, because there's no other way around it, man. There's no other way around it. It's going to kill when I stick that needle in there.
I like, no, you're going to be fine. It won't hurt.
Do you ever stop for a second? Like, I got to go outside and like barf. Or just want to like...
When that stuff hits you in the face. Yeah, then you do. You know.
Oh, you need one of those...
It's like death.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking. Just flies in your face, like
like a scene from Aliens. Attacking you.
Yeah, and then it like goes through the mask. Like, oh no. Yeah, that's what death is. It's death inside your body, and then it's coming out. Oh
yeah.
Vice versa, when you see, again, as a human, if you're doing an inspection on people, not inspection, whatever they're called.
Yeah, examination.
Examination.
Yeah. Inspection.
There are women that have super nice bodies.
Yep.
As a man, how do you not get worked up from that or turned on, or
well,
do you?
Well, first of all, when you see a woman, you're not supposed to be alone in the room with her, period, no matter what she looks like.
Okay.
You have to have with you, again, another cost of medicine, you have to have a chaperone with you.
Oh,
preferably another woman. Number one. And if you're really mentally invested in taking care of this patient, you can compartmentalize, and the way she looks really doesn't affect you. I mean,
do you even think about it later, though?
Yeah.
You do?
Okay. Too late, then.
Okay. Yeah.
And another interesting is in Miami, where we had that great big OB department, girls say, I want to be a gynecologist and obstetrician because only a woman can possibly understand the needs of another woman. And then they go into the obstetrics rotation, and they will observe things and smell things they have never experienced in their lives. So in Miami, what do you call a 5 foot, 350-pound woman?
What?
Slim. And you put a speculum into their vagina to do a pelvic exam, and stuff squirts out at you.
Oh, God.
And, yes. And insects crawl out.
No way.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely. And the smells and sights, and we call it Fremunda cheese. You lift this gigantic this gigantic pendulous breast up, and you think you have to be sure, because there's so many folds that somewhere around the area that might be her abdomen, you think it's pretty much a breast.
You got to look for a nipple to make sure it's a breast.
Yeah, yeah. And you somehow lift this gigantic pendulous breast up. And again, there's insects and there's it's yeast. It's, we call it fromunda, like fromunda, you boob, fromunda cheese.
Is it cheese?
Oh, and fromunda. It, and yeah. The smell is, it defies description. So after about the first or second week of OBGYN, here are all these girls now saying, maybe dermatology or maybe general.
Because they can't hack the smell.
Oh, you know, you think, oh, all you're looking at is, you know, attractive boobs and nice vaginas all day. No. No.
That's what my friend Sam Tripoli says. He talks about, like, being a male prostitute. He goes, all his friends are like, yeah, it's awesome, fucking all day. He goes, what kind of women do you think get male prostitutes? You think those are nines and tens? Yeah. It was the parade of monsters that would be coming through your door.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. How do you deal with the other side of the spectrum there when women come in and you've got to deal with them and it's you're not even sure it's a woman?
That's exactly right.
Do you ever want to tell people, like, what are you doing? You're going to die. You're not going to live to see 50 if you stay this fat.
Well, I try that, you know, and people say, well, I don't know why I can't lose the weight. All I do is drink water and eat salads. It must be a glandular disease. You have all their tests. No, it's not your thyroid. No, it's not your pituitary. No, it's not any of those things. And, you know, you see these people if you go to Sweet Tomatoes or Super Salads. You see these same people. And they do eat salad with 5 gallons of the blue cheese dressing and all the pie in the dessert area. And
sugar
big
on their Caesar salads. Yeah, sugar.
You see these same people and you go, you know, oh, you know, and this simple equation, no matter how you cut it, there is no way around it. What you weigh, the amount of fat you have, is determined by how many calories you burn in a given day versus how many calories you put into your body a given day. If you exceed the number of calories you burn by what you eat, your body will store much of that as fat, period, in a sentence. Some people need a little bit more than others. Some need a little bit less than others. But if you're obese, and it's not your thyroid and it's not your pituitary gland or other obvious things,
then
you're eating more calories than you need to sustain yourself properly.
Does that amount of calories go down with age?
Your metabolic rate, in a manner of speaking, declines with age.
I feel like I only need 7 hours of sleep now when I used to need 8.5.
I don't know the actual reason for that. Older folks generally seem to sleep a lot less than younger folks do. And I don't.
They're getting closer to dying. They're trying to stay awake longer.
I need this time. I need to use this time.
Time goes by so much more quickly.
No, I'm the same way now. I go to bed at midnight or 1 in the morning, and I still wake up without an alarm at 7.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. I prefer to sleep in, but now I'm
But you remember before where your father would have to punch you, and you're like, Dad, I'm sleeping, and you can just sleep through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you see pills being overprescribed to people?
Oh,
because it seems like it's first advice every run through the door. You need to walk more and eat more salads.
You know, I mean, pills mean for dieting or
all of it.
The amount of medicine that is overprescribed, I can't even put it into words. My happiest patients and some of the most self-satisfying things that I do is to remove a patient from a lot of medicines. Mm. Doctors are really good at adding medicines and increasing the dosages. Many doctors, most doctors, suck at decreasing dosages and taking medicines away. So you'll start a patient on a medicine that's probably necessary, like a blood pressure medicine.
Okay.
And then they get a side effect. And you don't recognize it as that and say, oh, well, let's give you a medicine to treat that side effect. And then that second medicine has its own side effect, and the list continues. And sometimes, obviously, people don't step back for a second and see the forest through the trees. Because if you go to a new office, and you have this medicine list of 20 medicines, no kidding, and you go, how can it be possible that people need all these medicines?
And no doctor goes, whoa, hold on. You're taking all that? No, let's step way back.
Well, amazingly, not many seem to. And when I see a patient like that, they don't ever feel well, and you can't take in that many medicines, you know. The first thing I see is, I want to try to cut back on some of these medicines, or if your initial medicine for which this whole cascade started was something like your blood pressure, and you weigh 280 pounds, and you're 5'3", and you're diabetic or pre-diabetic, well, and now you're on all these medicines to treat the diseases, plus all these medicines to treat the side effects, blah, 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 blah. Well, how about maybe you might want to get to the root cause of it and lose some of your mid-abdominal fat, and then you don't need the blood pressure medicine, or maybe not even the diabetes medicine, and thus all the the cascaded medicines that followed after that.
Yeah, kill the head vampire.
But people,
then all the other vampires die.
People are their worst enemies. They, you know, it's like,
that's not the American way. Eat everything and just take more drugs.
That's right. There will be a pill for this.
Answer.
Yeah, there'll be a. And,
I'll tell you, those pills do help sometimes, though, don't they?
Oh, sometimes they're absolutely necessary. Yeah. You know, medicines aren't evil. You know, and another important thing to remember, I've forgotten the name of the first toxicologist back in Greece. His name slips me.
I think it's Bob Jenkins.
It may be.
In ancient Greece? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I read that report, yeah.
The statement is it is not the drug, it's the dosage. Meaning that there is no inherently benign or toxic substance. For example, every day, well, you, of course, cyanide, that's not a good thing. You don't want cyanide.
Yeah.
But every day, you're taking cyanide because it off-gasses from your dashboard in your car. It's a low dose, so it doesn't bother you. Botulinum toxin, which will paralyze you and you can't breathe and you'll die. If you dilute it, way, way, way diluted, it's useful for many things. You know, Botox, but not just cosmetics. Useful for that, but many other things. On the other hand, each year, there'll be some people who die from water toxicity, usually like fraternity things, drinking so much water that
you
die.
Morning radio thing, somebody died. They chugged
it's not the from water. The medicine, it's the dosage, not the drug.
This book, The Population Bomb, I don't know if you remember it.
Yeah.
And then later they wrote The Population Explosion, and about how that's the number one problem with the planet right now, is just people breeding at an exponential rate. But they said, like, you can drop a drop of motor oil into a river, and you can do that, you know, every 10 minutes for a billion years, and the river will always just clear that. But if you drop that same amount in all at once, the river's dead forever.
Yeah. Nature has a great way of rejuvenating itself if you give it a chance.
Yeah. If you give it a chance. Yeah. The problem is that certain pills, when people say, like, pills are bad, it's like, eh.
The most overprescribed medicines are it's a misnomer, but they're called the antidepressants. They're used for many other things other than depression. They're used for compulsive disorder. They're used for anxiety. They're used for a number of other things, and validly so. But oftentimes, many of the things that are for which they're prescribed come about for a treatable reason. I mean, I'll get off the track here, but sometimes people's mood or depression, something as simple as testosterone. You give them testosterone, and suddenly they're feeling great, and you've discontinued their SSRI, or SNRI.
Because that's what they're missing.
That was their, or other things that were, or their thyroid is really low. That's another reason for depression.
I'm
often missed, or not even really low, but just not at the level that their particular body would like. And you treat that, and then you...
Instead of treating the symptom, you're treating something.
And you're able to taper them off because, really, you know, the way that the antidepressants make you feel, for lack of a better prescription, is kind of emotionally numb. They make you feel kind of flat. They decrease your ups and your downs a little bit.
There's a lot of them like that.
Yeah, but that wasn't necessarily needed. Sometimes they are.
Yeah.
Yes, but
right. That's what I mean by overprescribed. Not like these are all wrong.
It just means, like, they're not evil. Often. But they are way overprescribed. I'm feeling down. My mood's been kind of bad. Oh, here you go. Here's a little Paxil or Prozac or here's, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Is that also a doctor's way of just going like, fine, it's this. Just do this.
Well, you got to see so many patients in a day that you can't. And the other irony
is... You got to play the odds, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the other irony about you have to see more and more patients and spend less and less time. Patients get more and more unhappy with that. We have a very litigious society, and the more patients you see, you can get sued for anything.
How much does malpractice hold you back from delivering the best care? The threat of it?
I think a lot of the time. If you look at a patient's chart, 80% or more of its thickness, a patient's chart, has not to do with taking care of that medicine. That's to cover your butt against insurance companies, boards of medicine, et cetera, et cetera. It takes up so much time and so much effort.
How do you get around that?
Unfortunately, William Shakespeare first, kill all the lawyers.
Kill the lawyers.
Which obviously means kill most of the politicians, too.
Dude, I feel the same way about comedy. You should see it. When they give you these lists, these notes of what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say. What are you talking about? Of course I'm allowed to say that. They had to beep. I did a story online, so Comedy Central shot them for me. But it was about something in high school about this girl I wanted to fuck and lose my virginity to, and they had to beep her name. I'm like, why? They're like, well, what if she gets upset? I'm like, upset that I wanted to lose my virginity to her? That's not, I'm allowed to say that. But these lawyers just go, ah, nah, beep it. And I'm like, that takes people out of it. You're ruining stuff. Why are you ruining shit? They're fucking lawyers.
Isn't it part of your First Amendment right to say that?
Yeah.
If you want to be stupid, I can be stupid.
Yeah.
I see it all the time.
Let
never
you me and get mad at me.
Who has said never underestimate the stupidity of the population? Something like that.
Wait, I had one. I forgot what it was. Oh, how do you find jobs? How do you get job at work as a doctor? Because I see all these guys in LA that are like helping their income by just recommending weed. Those weed doctors are like, well, you know, $60 a pop. Just let's go. Whip them through.
And that's such a prostitution of medicine. I'm not saying anything for or against weed.
It's a prostitution of medicine.
It is. It is an absolute 100% prostitution of medicine because the vast majority of people getting their marijuana cards are getting it for recreational use.
Absolutely.
It's not to really be taking care of a medical problem. And when doctors say, oh, yeah, by the way, I'm an ophthalmologist. Weed for glaucoma? There has never, ever been a case of glaucoma that wasn't easily treatable by medicines that suddenly marijuana was the medicine that took care of it. That is a total 100% travesty.
But you don't think it helps with like back pain, shit like that?
Well,
normal little things?
It does. It absolutely can. And by the way, you don't want to ask me what I think. I think I'm good looking. That tells you what my opinion is. What you like to know is what the evidence-based medicine shows.
Fuck yeah.
And
that's exactly what you should say.
It, for things, it is very good. I mean, for nausea, for people who have really intractable problems, yeah. But, you know, people come in and doctors will pretty much, I'm 26 years old. I can't live with my back pain.
Yeah.
You're 20 or 22 years old. How'd you get all this back pain? Oh, and pain is one of those things, and nausea is one of those things.
Leaning forward,
you
smoking from the bong.
Quantify, you know.
That's why I get rid of it.
So, I mean, it's got to, if you had kind of a conscience after your, like, maybe your first or second week of saying this person has this particular problem so they can get a marijuana card. And if it doesn't eat at your brain, then you're pretty much a prostitute.
Jeremy, you're not allowed to smoke, right?
No, I don't smoke.
Have you never smoked, even in high school and shit?
Nope.
Golly, when you retire?
When I retire, unfortunately, I'm probably going to blow up to about 500 pounds.
I can see that.
I'm going to be like Jabba the Hutt. I'll just have a little platform in the gym set up where I can just have a little stick to point at people.
You're doing it wrong. Get me more of campaign. Yeah,
refer to the video.
That's my biggest weakness is junk food and sugar and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll be huge.
I had this doctor. I mean, I did the first time I said sleeplessness and I said depression. And the last time I did it, I was like, I'm not playing this game anymore. And whenever they said, what are your symptoms, I go, no symptoms, I just like to get high just to see what they would do. Worst case scenario, I figure they'll take my $40 and not give it back. That's the worst case. And then the doctor saw me and he goes, so, you know, how long have you having problems? I'm like, dude, I don't have any problems. I'm really healthy. I enjoy getting high. He just rolled his eyes and like wrote the prescription.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh my God!
Like it's such a sham, and they all know it.
Well, that's what
it's like. This isn't bad for you, fucking.
And I am not impugning weed at all or marijuana.
You're just
at all.
Impugning the prostitution of giving it out that way.
To say that in order for people to use the drug, or use if you want to call it a drug, it is that you have to get a physician, an MD or DO or whatever, to say that you have this problem.
Yeah,
I think that's a total perversion of the whole system. Either, you know, legalize it, make it completely illegal, whatever.
Yeah, to call it medical is, like, ridiculous.
But to say, give him a medical marijuana card on the basis of some guy just putting his name and collecting his money for doing that. A lot of people are doing it.
Yeah, it's prostitution.
Some places open up in Arizona, they are going hand over fist.
They just got it, right?
They're exploding. In fact, one of my patients is the person who's running them all. It's a gal. They're opening up places hand over fist. They can't keep up with the demand. And
just because you make people go through that system to get to the second thing, you want to get to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, come on. Then in this case, if you're going to do that, and because of that, legalize this. Just completely
go Seattle.
Legalize it.
Go like Seattle.
Don't make professionals prostitute themselves.
A guy in a wheelchair come into a dispensary, a pot dispensary, or someone with a cane or something, you see almost always everyone in the store will just kind of like, go ahead, man. You're the reason we're here. We're all fine.
You're a celebrity. Yeah. You go ahead. You actually need it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You're the rock star, dude. Yeah. Come on in.
So how do you get jobs? What's the application process to find a job somewhere?
Well, it's actually the application process is really kind of torturous and long. There's, of course, the application form, but then there's a thing called credentialing. And credentialing is one of these things that gives people jobs because a certain person or persons have to go, and it doesn't matter that you have a license and the licensing board has checked all of your credentials. It doesn't matter that you have malpractice insurance and they've checked all your credentials, yeah. And whether you belong to a hospital and they've checked all your credentials. But then every time you apply to a job, there is somebody who's a credentialing monitor who then has to check all your credentials. And the older you are, and the more jobs you've ever had, yeah. And the more heartbeats you have, the more difficult it is for credentialing to occur because there's more stuff to be checked upon. And that whole
process. So you're less hireable then?
Well, not necessarily less hireable, but it takes a lot longer. It can take months to be credentialed.
And they want to make sure you haven't molested anybody in any of your jobs?
Yeah, they're rechecking all the stuff that all the other agencies have already done. Because if you don't, of course, and something slips through the cracks, you're going to get sued. Again, kill all the lawyers first. But that process can, in the case of someone who's, you know, been around for a long time, can take 2 or 3 months for credentialing. No kidding.
Whoa.
And by that time, you know.
Is that because of ineptitude, or is that just because that's how long it takes?
That's just how long it takes. And you know, it's a job. If you work too quickly, you're going to be out of a job.
Yeah, I guess so.
And, you know, that makes certain other people more attractive, you know, to be hired than you. And also,
because they take less time,
right.
If you're out of medical school.
And also for you, you know, if they offer you a job and say, okay, now fill out all the paperwork, and now here comes all the paperwork for credentialing, which takes sometimes a week to fill out or more. And then you got to wait for the process to occur, and suddenly other jobs are maybe popping up for you. They say, well, what do I do now? You know, do I go and go for that other job, but I'm in the process in the first job? Because it's such an extensive time. It's a very complicated process to become employed as a physician.
Wow. How is it hard? How do you get jobs? I mean, you're in the UFC and you've got a relationship with them.
Yeah.
But barring that, you have to sell yourself to a company?
Yeah, no, I have a manager.
Promotes you.
I'd imagine it's a lot like being a comic. You have a manager, they shop you out to different places. They negotiate the contract for you, and then they say, okay, this is the fight I found, this is when it is, this is who you're fighting, this is what you get paid.
And so, but they'll be like, no, he always puts on exciting fights.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
50 grand instead of
absolutely.
10 grand.
Yep. Wow. Yep, that's just the manager's job. That's how they do it.
Yeah. Okay, I've got four more questions, then we go downstairs and watch fights. First of all, separate question. This will come out after the fights. Prediction for Silva and Weidman.
Man, that's a tough one.
I know it is.
Weidman obviously is very, very talented, but nobody can argue that Silva got caught screwing around in the first fight.
Got caught screwing around.
So, you know, if he fights straight and clean,
then it's who knows.
Yeah, exactly. And it's still a toss-up because Weidman with the wrestling advantage, you know, that's a huge mark. You know, I don't know. It's a coin flip.
Yeah, what do you say? I'm saying Silva.
I'm saying the same kind of thing. I think if Weidman is able to get it and keep it on the ground, it would be Weidman. If Anderson can keep it on the feet, then it's going to be Anderson.
All these people after the first fight that were like, see, I told you, Weidman. I'm like, you didn't think that would happen.
Nobody thought it was going to get one standing up by Weidman.
Yeah.
I just want to see a really good fight.
I would like to see
Silva win just because, nothing against Weidman. He's a great guy, and I think he'll do amazing things in the sport. But I'd like to see Silva win just because, just to kind of shut up the people that are really ragging on him for the last fight.
They're ragging
on him. It was a fluke. Yeah, Weidman caught him playing around.
Disrespectful. That's what he gets. I'm like, what do you get from him? Shut up.
No, you know, I've talked to plenty of people that know him, and I've talked to him myself. I fought him myself. And the thing is, he's a very respectful guy. Yeah. But the way he operates in the ring is designed to make people get frustrated and angry and fight badly. So being disrespectful in the ring to elicit a reaction is not the same as being disrespectful outside the ring. And he's never disrespectful outside the ring.
Sonnen, that's why all the Brazilians want to kill him.
Yeah.
That's what Dana said when they were going to have that fight in Brazil.
No.
And he goes, the only thing we got to figure out, and he goes, I'm not joking, is we have to figure out a way to get him out of the octagon without being killed if he wins. Like, we need a tunnel.
Yep.
All right, a couple more questions and we'll go watch. Obamacare.
Good,
pro,
good
con,
question.
Or don't care?
I will tell. No. I will tell you this unabashedly.
Okay.
If you ask any 100 doctors who are not employed by the government, like VA, Indian Health Service, etc.,
okay,
99 out of 100 will tell you it's the end of medicine as we know it.
Wow.
And that's true. If you ask the big parade of doctors in white coats behind Obama when he announced it, those were all government employee doctors. They get a paycheck. They get 4 weeks off of vacation a year. They get 2 weeks off for medical education.
But regular doctors, why would it be the end of medicine?
Because the reimbursements will continue to go down so dramatically that they won't be able to provide. Lots of doctors have dropped out of medicine already, and the rate of increase of them dropping out since the Obamacare thing is kicking in has increased rapidly. And for everyone out there who is thinking that, and there's still a lot of you out there, oh, January 1st, I'm getting health insurance. I'm getting Obamacare.
Yeah.
It's like, it's another entitlement. It's going to come, I'm going to have insurance. I'm going to get, no, you are 100% wrong. What that means is as of January 1st, you must go out and buy
insurance.
Your insurance. And if you do not, your friendly IRS folks will come and collect the penalties from you directly. And now when you go on to the U.S.
January 1st has to be?
Well, that's when it all kicks in. Yep.
Oh, I got to do that.
And if you don't get insurance, you'll get penalized. And when you go to the healthcare.gov website, to the insurance exchange, first of all, of course, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And second of all, if it works, it doesn't connect to the insurance companies like it was supposed to. But most importantly, you will now find that essentially the same plan that you could have gotten before Obamacare laws got passed is now significantly more expensive.
They dropped from SAG, from Screen Actors Guild. Mm-hmm. They dropped mental health coverage from anyone mm-hmm. on Plan 2. They have Plan 1, which if you make a certain amount of money, you qualify. But Plan 2, like, no, you can't. I'm like, why? And they're like, with Obamacare, we have to offer the same amount of coverage to everyone or forget
it. That is right.
So before they offered, like, 50 visits for Plan 1 and 15 visits for Plan 2. And now they're like, you get nothing.
And this is not a political statement. It's a statement of fact. Listen to all the things that President Obama said before he became president. He wanted a single-payer health plan.
What
government,
does that mean?
Government insurance. One insurance. The U.S. government.
Okay.
Period. And since then, be politically correct, of course, he's changed the tone. But in reality, it's what he wants, and he will get it because it will be impossible for private insurance companies to remain in business because they have to cover more and more things. For example,
plan is a problem because then there's no, you can't shop around.
Well, and also it's no longer insurance. It's not insurance anymore. It's health, it's cost sharing. For example, if you're John Smith, you're 24 years old, you have a garage full of man toys, very expensive stuff, but I don't need health insurance. I'm 23-year-old, I'm bulletproof, I'm armor-plated.
You're paying for the 80-year-olds with your taxes.
Well, now, though, let's just say, gee, my testicles ache. I go to the doctor, and I have this real weird nodule. The doctor goes, oh, well, look at this. You have testicular cancer. You have a couple of options. You can live and win the Tour de France like Lance Armstrong, or you can die. The choice is yours. Well, I want to live. Well, okay, well, the treatment altogether is going to cost, maybe $600,000. I don't have insurance. I can't afford that. Well, now you can trundle on over to Blue Cross Blue Shield and say, hey, I want to buy, quote, insurance, unquote, from you. I have testicular cancer. And Blue Cross Blue Shield can't say no. They have to take you.
They have to.
It's a and now all the premiums have to go up to pay for that. People
right.
can't afford the premiums. More people have lost their health insurance plans than have gotten
that was unexpected.
Stuff.
I first heard about Obamacare, I guess I'm a libertarian, but I'm a bleeding heart libertarian,
mm-hmm.
where I'm like, we need to take care of each other.
But not with the government.
Yeah.
Inefficient.
But my thought was like, other like Canada I go to a lot. I'm like, if you get sick, you can just go to the doctor and you don't have to pay for it. Like, it's covered. It might not be the best coverage, but it's covered. And I was like, we need that. But now I'm like, oh, wait, it's not just covered here under Obamacare. You just have to, they're just making you pay for it. They're just forcing you to buy insurance.
It's
different than making sure everyone's covered.
And that's pretty unique that the government can force you to buy something you don't necessarily want.
Just by not calling it a tax, calling it something else.
Yep. So there you go. Ante up the money and buy your insurance and get a policy. Otherwise, just pay the money to the IRS.
And then still don't have insurance.
And they are a tough collection agency.
Yeah, they'll get your money. Okay, two more questions. How do you not constantly get sick being a doctor?
Who says I don't?
Do you? Really?
Well, yeah. People will routinely, cough and sneeze in your face. And after a while, you do develop a little better immunity, I suppose. But it's not that you don't get sick. You just push through it. You work. You go to work sick, and you try to protect patients by washing your hands, wearing a mask or whatever. You may feel sicker than hell, but you got to go to work. Gee, I have 20 patients scheduled this morning, and I woke up feeling like crap. Oh, I got to stop. My knees are shaking. My teeth are chattering, and I just wish I would die, but I got to get in there, and you do. You just push it and make it. Wow. And so, yeah, you get sick, but you just push through it.
Okay. Well, Rogan's got to go, so we got to go get our tickets. Jeremy Horn, you have a Twitter account or something?
I do. It's Jeremy Horn Elite.
Elite?
Yep.
Was Jeremy Horn taken?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Okay. I don't really do a whole lot with it. Some of the guys at the gym have been pushing me to get a little more socially, medially aware, I guess, if that's a word. But yeah, I'm a hermit. I'd rather stay at home and train and just deal with my friends. But I got to try to get out there a little bit more into the world. So they made me get one.
It'll be the new self-promoting Jeremy Horn coming
out.
Yeah, it's tough, too. Do you have a website?
I do.
So where people can find your gym and stuff?
Yep. Yeah, we have a website for the gym. We've got a website. I also promote a small fight show in Salt Lake.
Salt Lake?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Why did I think you were in Iowa?
I was for a long time. I've been in Salt Lake for about 10 years now. I was in Iowa before.
You ever go to Wise Guys?
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to get booked there. Hopefully, I'll be there soon. All right.
Yeah, you and Joey?
Joey, he's going there in January. I'm going to make sure to go see him. Yeah.
Okay, nice. What do you have? Anything to promote?
Hormone optimization.
Better
health. That's right. Take care of yourself. Don't look for the doctor. Do it. Lose some weight. Get some exercise. Watch what you eat.
Yeah. That's all it comes down to at some point, right? And people are like, how'd you lose weight? Like, I ran around a bunch and I ate green things.
I saw a t-shirt. I want to get one time. It said just the universal diet plan. And then under that, it said, move more, eat less.
Yeah,
there you go.
Very nice. All right. Let's watch some people make each other unhealthy.
Let's see it happen.
Thanks, guys. That's it. That's the episode. That's a lot of that's pretty surprising. Fucking $30 a pop to get a doctor visit? I'm definitely going to say thank you for my doctor from now on. And I'm going to give him free pass to the Comedy Store every time I see him. Like, why not? $30 a pop. Wow. I mean, I wanted to get more into it, but we had to go. It just is not what it was cracked up to be when I was little of like, oh, you're a doctor. That's the best thing. So that's the episode, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, if you are doing any Amazon shopping, to go through my website. Go to arithegreat.com. There's an Amazon link and an Amazon for Canada link right next to it. It's just on the right-hand side towards the top. Just click on that. It takes you to Amazon, and then you can do all your shopping as normal. It helps me out. It lets me pay for all my parking tickets. And the weed. I got back to L.A. And the first day, I went right to Runyon Canyon to hike. It was 8 degrees in New York when I moved. 8 degrees. And fucking 75. We went to Runyon, took my shirt off with Simone and Matt Edgar. I'll catch her in the rye. He's got that. It's so nice here, you guys. It's so fucking nice. The weather is goddamn beautiful. There's just no denying it. It's beautiful. But I went and got my pot license renewed. I tried doing the same thing, saying, like, no, I don't have any problems. They're like, no, what are your symptoms? I'm like, nah, I'm good. I take weed and I don't have any symptoms. And they're like, she leveled with me, the nurse practitioner for the guy. She goes, you gotta say something. I got to write something down. So I was like, ugh, sleeplessness. It's so easy to get your pot license. But now that we have Colorado and soon to be Washington selling legal weed, what are we doing? Why are we jumping through these stupid hoops? We're all fine. You know we're all fine. Anyway, everybody's living life. It's really nice, you guys. By the way, a 4-year-old toddler was killed in Afghanistan because it was foggy and the U.S. soldiers didn't know that it wasn't an insurgent, so they gunned down a 4-year-old. Aren't we done over there? Shouldn't we just move away? We're killing their kids. That kid didn't do anything to us. We're just shooting 4-year-olds. Oh, it was a mistake. Why are we there with a bunch of guns? So that's it. Don't forget, come to San Diego. That's the only time you're going to see this material before it's done. La Jolla Comedy Store on January 16th, Thursday. And when I'm there, I might go with Steve Simone, and we're going to Don Carlos Taco Shop. If you guys at all are in the San Diego area or in La Jolla, stop by Don Carlos. It's on Pearl Street in La Jolla, and it's a delicious, delicious burrito. And they have an Ari Shaffir burrito. They have the Trevino, which is really good, and they have an Ari Shaffir, which is ham, bacon, sausage, probably cheese, just to make it extra non-kosher. So check out Don Carlos right there on Pearl Street, like a block away from the Comedy Store and across the street. All right, you guys, thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to check out last week's podcast, listen to my album, and share it with some other people, because I want, you know, I'm giving it away. Let as many people hear it as possible. It's just a free album. Revenge for the Holocaust. It's not a dark theme like some of these. All right. I'll see you guys later. Bye. Such a muddy line between the things you want.